Welcome to the For the Church podcast, another great gospel-centered resource from Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary. My name is Jared Wilson. I'm an assistant professor of pastoral ministry and author in residence at Midwestern Seminary. And I'm here as always with my friend and my colleague and my co-host, Ross Ferguson. How are you, brother?
I'm slightly nervous.
Okay.
There is a wasp on the floor next to me.
Oh, is it alive?
Yeah.
You need me to come over there and kill it?
Well, no. It's just, it looks half dead, to be honest, but It is moving. So
we'll step on it so it doesn't start flying around.
Well, okay. Back in a second.
I thought you were telling me because you...
It's dead.
I remember once my daughter texted me, as they would often do, and she texted me, she says, "There's a gigantic spider on my ceiling. I need you to come kill it." And what she forgot was that I was four states away at a speaking engagement. And I said, "You're out of luck because I'm not in the house." And she goes, "Oh, yeah." I said, I basically cheerleaded her through. I was like, "You're going to have to do it yourself. This is what you do." And I like talked her through. But it was a nightmare.
It would have been a very expensive trip back.
Right. Let me come back and kill the big spider for you. Hey, I've got some beefs. It's been a while.
It's been a while.
I told you before that I had a couple of beefs I was saving up. Well, one beef.
Your main beefs tend to be around airports and airlines.
Yeah. And this one involves at least one example isn't an airport.
Okay.
But it's not about the airline.
Okay.
So my current beef right now is stores or businesses that close before they close.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm talking about?
Mm-hmm.
They close before they close. So I'm just going to give you an example. This was in the Dallas, I don't remember which Dallas airport. I don't know if it was Love Field or Dallas-Fort Worth. But in any event, it's the one that has Baskin-Robbins in it. And I wanted a milkshake. And I walked into Baskin-Robbins in the Dallas airport. And it was 20 minutes before they closed. So it was like 8, I think they closed at 9. And mm-hmm. I walked into 8:40 but in any event, 20 minutes. And there's no one else in there. There's no line, nothing. It's just the workers. And I walk in and she goes, "We close in 20 minutes. And I thought, I mean, my first, I'm like doing the math. I look at my watch. I'm like, okay, that's. Yeah, 20 minutes. Okay. That seems like it's some time.
It seems like enough.
I was like, it's not a sit down restaurant. I just want some ice cream.
Yeah.
And so I like looked at her and she's looking at me and she's basically saying, "We're closed," even though they're not closed.
Yeah.
So when you say we close in 20 minutes to somebody because you don't want to serve them, you're saying we're closed now. And man, I was like so frustrated, so irritated. And I just turned around. I didn't like argue with her or anything. I just turned around and walked out, and I thought, all right, I guess that's one way to run a business.
Yep.
It happened to me again last week. I was going to get my hair cut, went down to the Sport Clips, and they normally are open on this day. I was looking at the hours. They're open until 7. I walk in at 4 p.m., 3 hours before they're supposed to close. As soon as I walk in, one of the ladies who's cutting hair goes, "We're closing at 5 today." So I'm doing the math in my head.
Yep.
Oh, you're closing at 5 today for, I guess, maybe they're understaffed or something, which, okay, that's fine. It's 4 p.m. That means there's an hour. There's nobody waiting. Again, that's rare. You walk into Sport Clips, you check in. I don't know if you've ever been there, but they show you on the big screen what order you're in, mm-hmm. how long it should take. There's no one on the screen. They're cutting someone's hair in that moment, but it's just me, and there's a whole hour. And so I say, like an idiot, "We close at 5 today." I look, it's 4 p.m. And I say, "Does that mean you can cut my hair or not?" And this is exactly what she said to me. "I'm not going to say yes and I'm not going to say no." And I just thought, huh. And so I sat down and I waited for about 10 minutes before I realized that means no.
Yeah.
I just kept thinking about it. I'm just stewing about it. I'm not going to say yes. I'm not going to say no. And I thought, even if it means yes, she's not going to be happy.
No.
And you don't want someone who's unhappy with sharp scissors by your head. So I left, even though they closed at 5 that day, I left at like 4:10 and drove down the road to the other Sport Clips and got my haircut. What's the deal?
So I know that.
Closing before they close.
I probably know why the Baskin-Robbins one, but the haircut one's quite funny.
So why Baskin-Robbins?
Years ago, when I was 16, I worked at McDonald's, and you would switch off the milkshake and ice cream machine because you had to clean it. So it was we closed at midnight, and we would switch it off at 11 and start cleaning it from 11 so we didn't have to then clean it after we had closed because it takes hours to clean everything.
Then close at 11, Ross. That's what I'm saying.
Sure. Okay. I mean, you're right. You're not wrong. I just, I wonder why you were going for a milkshake late at night.
Because I wanted a milkshake.
And that's also wonder, I know a certain professor would say, your issue is not the fact that they were closing early or the fact that you went in at 4 p.m. Your issue is unpreparedness. And you should have been more prepared for your haircut and give yourself more time.
More time than than 3 hours? I thought I was walking in 3 hours early. I mean, you know.
You are right. I think that beef is warranted.
Okay.
I feel like I should have a button that says beef, like.
Beef approved.
Beef approved. What do we have? Do we have beef approved something?
I was thinking, like, so I'm not the kind of guy, for instance, I'll look up. If it is late and we're going to go out to eat or something and we got out of a movie or whatever. Yeah. I'm not the guy who walks in at 8:55 and they close at 9 I'm not going to do that.
Yeah.
So I'm not thinking like that. But I was thinking when I worked in retail, the door was unlocked all the way up until the time we closed. Yep. And if somebody walked in 5 minutes before close, they walked in before 5 minutes for close. And we might make an announcement, you know, hey, we're closing in 5 minutes or 10 minutes or whatever it is. So, you know, make your final purchases. But we're not saying to somebody who walks in, like, you can't walk in because we're not really closed, but we're really closed.
Yeah.
That just to me is bad customer service and especially 20 minutes.
Yeah. I mean,
to scoop some ice cream. If you want to start cleaning,
clean other things.
Then I'm just saying don't close at 9, close at 8.
Yeah.
Instead, if that's when you want to start cleaning, is at 8, then close at 8. That's what I think.
Miriam and I recently visited the Omaha Zoo with the family, and they have like a firm closing time. I think it was 5 p.m. or something like that. Mm-hmm. But their rule is they just won't accept anyone in after 5 p.m. And then you've got time to kind of still go around. So they're closed for guests coming in at 5, but not closed as in everybody has to be out at 5.
Yeah.
So even just with that policy, you could say, you know, we close at 9, which means just so you know, like at 9 p.m. we're going to close the doors for other people, but you can still come in, you know, right now.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, I say beef warranted.
Okay. Speaking of the zoo, like zookeepers, talking about moms today.
Oh, I wouldn't do that.
Who very often, who have to feel like they're taking care of wild animals sometimes. Okay. That's what I was going to I meant it as commendatory. Not that they themselves are zoo animals, but zookeepers.
Okay.
Sometimes I see moms on social media. They refer to it like, yeah, you know, here's my wild zoo or the people. So anyway, maybe that beef wasn't approved. Awesome moms of the Bible. Mm-hmm. It's Mother's Day this weekend, or at least the timing of this episode is supposed to be. And this is the question I was going to ask you first of all. Is Mother's Day a thing over in the UK?
On a different day.
Oh, it is?
Yeah.
What's the day for Mother's Day in the UK?
30th of March, I believe. It's like the last Sunday of March.
Why'd you all do that? Is there another holiday?
We were there first.
So it was Mother's Day before the American Mother's Day?
I don't know, but we were there first, so like we get carte blanche on it.
I don't know. I should have looked up the history of Mother's Day. I thought like Hallmark or somebody invented this thing.
I don't know. I just know that we're on a different day for Mother's Day. But yes, we do it.
And you have a Father's Day as well?
Yep. And okay. We Mother's Day is on the last Sunday of March, and we call it Mothering Sunday. So let's say the Christian world calls it Mothering Sunday.
Okay.
But yeah, we have it. And we also spell mum different from mom.
M-U-M.
We mum. Spell it mum. So in this episode, when you hear mum, hear mom.
Okay. Mum over here is a flower.
Okay. Yes. Yes, indeed. Because somebody said to me that the first time I learned this, somebody said on campus, we're pulling out all the mums from the ground.
And I was like, whoa. Don't do that to the moms.
So now I just say mother because I feel like mother handles that cross-cultural issue.
Yeah. So in honor of Mother's Sunday, Mother's Day, we're having our favorite moms of the Bible, or awesome moms of the Bible.
Yeah.
I've got a short list.
I've got three.
I have three also.
Okay.
I wonder if there's any overlap.
I'm going to go first.
You go first.
Time. Last episode, you went first.
Okay.
So my mother I'm raising to the title of awesome is the mother of Moses.
Okay. I don't have your last. Okay. Jochebed? How do you say it?
I don't know the name. I didn't have the name in my head.
Oh, think her name's Jochebed or something like that.
Well, Exodus 2.
I'm gonna look it up now.
Mother of Moses. There's kind of three things that stand out. Her willing sacrifice to... She hid Moses for as long as possible and then put him in a basket and sent him down the water. That level of sacrifice for a mother, one, to spend 3 months hiding a baby. Like, if you've had a baby, that's tricky to do. And two, the sacrifice to let him go. Then second, that we read about her tender, loving care when she receives Moses back to care for him. And then the sacrifice all over again to send him away again. And just the heartache she must have gone through, yet always thinking, what is best for this son of mine? You know, that she could have in some form of way ran, hid, whatever, but just knew this is the best thing for my son to do this. And I'm trusting the Lord in this situation. So yeah, just that loving care, the sacrifice, the devotion to the Lord, to trust, if I put him in this basket, he'll be found. After weaning him, I can hand him back and God's going to use him, that this is still going to be for his good. And the thing that stood out for me was the long-term nature of that devotion, that mothering is not about the day-to-day as much as it's about the long-term. So I'll say this in sermons, that the days are long, but the years are short. That every day can feel like a millennium in terms of just caring for children. But mothers think about that long term, that those daily activities build to the long term. And I feel like that's what the mother of Moses does, that she daily is thinking long term, securing his life. She does what she thinks is right for him. And I think that's commendable in the situation. I mean, can you imagine that situation? The level of fear.
Scary it would have been. Yeah.
The level of fear. And then the level of fear to hear that Pharaoh's household, it's directly involved with your son, but you're going to now wean him and then hand him back. Mm-hmm. Like, even in that daily fear, what a mother to be able to give him the start that then God would use in incredible ways. And I was thinking about this episode and then fast forwarded to the end of Moses' life and what he does in terms of being used by God to lead the people, even on the mountainside, seeing the backhand of God.
Yeah.
And just thinking, wow, I wonder if she ever thought that's what God was going to use him for as she put him in the basket. Mm. Do you know? We don't know. We're not told. But incredible devotion to the Lord's blessing of a child in her life.
That the image or just the idea of putting your child in this basket and sending him down the river, it just had to be, it's an immense trust in the sovereignty of God and the care
of God.
And in the basket. But also I just think of the fear and the, and that's such a recurring theme when you think about just the mothers in the Bible, how many of them gave a child up.
Yes.
And sometimes it was things, Hannah with Samuel or something, just like giving them over. They're not necessarily like, I may be sending you to death perhaps, but to hand them over, to the Lord, essentially consecrating them. What Christian moms do.
I suppose that's what mothers do.
Whether you know your child or you're in proximity of your child for the rest of your life or not, in a sense, you're handing them over to the Lord and you're trusting the Lord. No, that was a good one. Yeah, I looked it up. It's Jochebed.
Jochebed.
I don't. Okay. I guess that's how you pronounce it. I don't know. My number one awesome mom of the Bible is Naomi.
Oh,
you have Naomi on your list?
I do not.
Okay, good. Here's why I love Naomi. So first of all, just for those who may not remember, Naomi is Ruth's mother-in-law. She's in the book of Ruth. Mm. Naomi has faced a lot. So she's lost her husband, right? So the whole family, her husband moves the whole family to Moab because there's a drought in Judah. And the sons, Naomi and Elimelech is her husband, they have two sons and they marry Moabite wives, which is not advisable, or at least culturally and religiously. Works out by the hand of God, of course, because Ruth is one of those wives. But Naomi loses her husband, Elimelech dies. Then she loses her sons, both of her sons die, and she's left with these two daughters-in-law. And the beginning of the book of Ruth has this really dramatic scene. They're returning to Judah, and Naomi basically says to her daughters-in-law, like, it's going to be rough for you. Like, you probably shouldn't come with me. They don't take kindly to Moabites where I'm from. So you probably want to go back to your own culture, your own people, you know, find husbands there. I'm too old to have a kid, et cetera. And one of the daughters-in-law turns back. Ruth does not. Ruth says, I'm going with you. You're coming with me. And so Ruth goes with Naomi. But in the beginning, this is what I love about Naomi, because she's like so dramatic.
Yeah.
And I'm picturing Ruth, the book of Ruth is like the prototypical kind of like Jane Austen novel or
okay.
almost yeah. like not romantic comedy, but yeah. like romance.
Yeah.
And Naomi goes, so in the beginning, she's like, don't call me Naomi. Call me Mara because I'm so bitter.
Yeah.
You know, the Lord has dealt bitterly with me. And, you know, Mara means bitter. And so I'm just picturing this woman just like, oh, you know, so melodramatic. And then she goes from melodramatic and, call me, you know, bitter and et cetera, to then, oh, there's a man and he's actually a kinsman redeemer and he's the next relative. At least they think.
Yeah.
The whole thing plays out like the template for some of these romance things. So they think this next guy, who is Boaz, is the first guy in line. And so Naomi like basically schemes with Ruth to figure out like, this is how you're going to get him, you know. You know, go present yourself to him, basically show that you're the relative and he's going to redeem the lineage and et cetera. And so she becomes kind of the puppet master in some way. That's probably overstating it. But yeah, the meddling mother-in-law, she really does love her daughter-in-law. It's not like a rough relationship between Naomi and Ruth or anything. But I just love that picture. Mm-hmm. It's almost humorous to me.
Yeah.
Here's how you do it. And then it comes full circle. There's a plot twist like in every romantic comedy or a conflict where Boaz actually isn't the first one in line. There is another guy, and so Boaz goes and talks to him, and so you're like, oh, no, Ruth's going to end up with this no-name guy, this kind of loser. I'm picturing some kind of loser, played by Bill Pullman or something in the movie. I mean, you know, Boaz goes, the guy, declines to redeem Ruth and the land and everything else. And so Boaz, saves the day. And the very final scene, which is one of my favorite moments just of contrast, is Naomi with her grandson.
Yeah.
Boaz and Ruth have a son. Naomi, I'm picturing her in the rocking chair with her grandson on her lap. She's gone from bitter to now this doting grandma. Yeah. And that contrast, it's just so sweet. I love it. It's heartwarming to me. And then to know kind of out of this lineage comes David. And out of David, of course, comes the Messiah. Yeah. So
I love the Book of Ruth, preached it multiple times. I'm hearing that you think it would make a great Christian movie.
It would, except the people who would make it would make it probably a bad Christian movie.
But I think she's great that she all of her emotions are there. You know, she's not pretending.
She's a great quote-unquote character. I mean, she's a real person. Yeah. I'm not saying she's fake or anything.
Yeah.
But she's a great character. Yeah. She's such a character.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I love Naomi.
Okay, next mother for me is the mother of Timothy, Eunice.
Oh, I have. Okay.
You have.
I have it too. Okay. So we'll just talk. Yeah, go ahead.
So barely mentioned in scripture. Acts 16, 2 Timothy 1. We don't have a lot of information about her, but what we do know is that she has a sincere faith that she has learnt from her mother. Do we know, was it her mother? Because it's Timothy's grandmother, but on dad's side or mom's side?
I don't know if we know that. We just know Lois and Eunice.
I guess we assume mother's side because dad is Greek. He isn't named as one of the in the faith.
Right.
And so a few things stand out to me. At number one, it's noted that she has a sincere faith while being married to a Greek, which is connotation of she wasn't being led to have a sincere faith by her husband. She had a sincere faith. And in that time, even as it is today, that's really hard to be in a household and have strong faith while your spouse, your life partner, your individual that you have come to be one together in, does not. So that's one commendable for her. But two, and here's the key thing for me, that Timothy was taught that sincere faith and he now has a sincere faith. And that clearly in Paul's mind has a correlation to the fact that his mother raised him in that way.
Yeah.
And again, that's then all the information we know about it from scripture. And for me, it's astounding to have those two things that without great support, she raised a son to have, and this was it. It wasn't that he was highly skilled. It wasn't that he, you know, was a great preacher. It wasn't that he was a great pastor. In fact, there's connotations in Timothy that he might not want to be where he is.
Yeah.
You know, he seems to be meek and mild. You know, we're not talking like Timothy is this star ministry worker, but he has a sincere faith. And that's the thing that just struck me as a mother, she concentrated on the right things and led her son to have sincere faith.
Yeah.
And that is, and to use your words, an awesome mother.
Yes.
So that's the thing she concentrated on. And it made me just think about, you know, my own wife, Miriam, and raising our kids that, you know, academics is not number one. Sports shouldn't be number one. How nice they are to people isn't number one. The number one thing we can do is to raise them to have a sincere faith by Eunice's example. And again, by contrast, I'm also then saying by Lois's example, there's a connotation that these are two mothers, the mother of Eunice, then the mother of Timothy. These mothers have worked together to lift a sincere faith.
Yeah, I had Lois and Eunice as well. 2 Timothy 1:3-5, I'm grateful to God, whom I worship with a clear conscience, this is Paul writing, as my ancestors did, as I remember you constantly in my prayers night and day. I yearn to see you again, recalling your tears, so that I may be filled with joy as I recall your sincere faith that first lived in your grandmother Lois and in your mother Eunice, and that I am confident lives also in you.
Yeah.
Awesome mom, awesome grandmom. And I think, as you said, the such an encouragement to those who may be kind of the stalwart holder of the faith, the mom or the grandmother, which is so common in families. You know, we hear so much about the influence of dads and how critical it is, a dad's role in everything, certainly in faith. And that's true. The stats are stacked against mom being the only believer for the kids to grow up and hold to the faith. And yet the Lord uses that faithfulness in ways often unseen.
Yeah.
When you feel so alone, you feel like you're the only one who believes, and will the kids, you know, hold to that faith, to just trust in the Lord and to have this sincere faith. And here's a couple of examples of a grandmother and a mother who, had a sincere faith alone in their families, and their the son and grandson Timothy becomes who he is because of them.
Yeah.
You know, and here's Paul, the apostle, who's pouring into Timothy, discipling Timothy, and he's crediting, hey, this is, you're carrying the baton passed from your mom and grandma. And it's just a sweet, sweet picture. Okay. You got your, we shared the second.
Yeah, we shared the second.
Okay.
My last one, by the way, before you go into it, I had two down and I don't know which way to go. You've kind of mentioned one already.
Oh, I did?
In passing. So let's hear your last one.
No, the one that I have is not one I mentioned already.
Okay, so I'm between two, so I don't know. But
so I don't have Hannah.
Okay, so that was I nearly went with Hannah, and main reason, because we've talked about this, that the sacrifice that she gave over Samuel to the Lord's work.
Yeah.
And I know this sounds really bad, but if we're talking about mothers that we want other mothers to emulate, if you will, I think we can just treat Hannah quite tritely, you know, just give your son up for, you know, and in some senses, I don't want to do this on this episode. So I went for the other one, and it's going to be a complete from left field. You go for your one, because I'm kind of almost nervous to say my last one.
So my final one that I have is Elizabeth, the mother of John the Baptist.
Okay, yeah.
And I picked her for a particular reason. Certainly, it's amazing that she had this incredible son that she dedicated to the Lord as well, and John the Baptist, of course, becomes, the forerunner, the prophetic, picking up the mantle of Elijah, essentially, resuming the prophetic word from the Lord after 400 years of silence to announce the coming of the Messiah. But that's not why I picked her. I picked her because when her cousin Mary comes to visit, and Mary is pregnant with Jesus, and Elizabeth is pregnant with John, Mary comes in, and Elizabeth is so humble.
Yeah.
She says, blessed are you among women, and your child will be blessed. And then she says, how could this happen to me that the mother of my Lord should come to me? Here is an expectant mom herself.
Incredible.
But she's already worshiping the unborn Messiah.
Yeah.
And the mother of the Messiah, she's so in awe. I was like, the mother of Jesus, who's going to be my Lord. My nephew is going to be my Lord, basically. Yeah. You know, and that you would come see me.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just such a, I don't know, the attitude there. I just think she had to be a really sweet lady. And she was an older lady as well. I mean, her conception was a miracle conception. It was sort of like, how am I going to get pregnant? Or at least her husband's thinking that. How is she going to get pregnant? She's, beyond age. And then she's carrying John the Baptist. And so she's a miracle story in and of herself. But her joy just seems to be in
Yeah.
In her cousin, in her cousin's baby.
And yes, there is a strong connection to the fact that she's worshipping Christ, the unborn Christ, if you will, in that moment. But I get the impression, almost if it wasn't Jesus, that she would still be really happy.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Do you know, does that make sense?
Well, and like John leaps in her womb as well. So just like, I don't know, just the whole portrait of it is just really sweet and really joyful.
And
so
that's a picture for like mothers today, pregnant mothers today, is to be thinking, you know, how can we honor other pregnant women while you're pregnant? Do you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, okay. Here's my last
one. Okay.
Eve.
Oh.
Eve,
out of left field.
Yeah.
Off the turnbuckle.
Yeah. So there is the thing that struck me about Eve, and this is the thing I think.
Eve was awful. This whole thing's her fault. What are you talking about?
So that's the name she gets. But here's the thing, and I'm going to actually just read it out and then kind of say why this struck me. At Genesis 4, verse 1, now Adam knew Eve, his wife, and she conceived and bore Cain, saying, I've gotten a man with the help of the Lord. Towards the end, verse 25 of chapter 4, and Adam knew his wife again, and she bore a son, and she called his name Seth, for she said, God has appointed for me another offspring. Having completely failed as a couple and being cursed, they then honor God's command and go forth and multiply. Mm. And not only does Eve have children, but then she continues to have children even after her son murdered the other son. And there is an element here of faithfulness even after you got something wrong. And it really just struck me that Eve did the monumental thing, but then turned it around. And then even under that curse, honored the command of God to go forth and multiply. Now, don't hear what I'm saying. I'm not saying every woman should go forth and multiply. What I'm saying here is she got something really badly wrong.
Yeah.
And then she turned around. And to me, it's a picture of how many women, how many couples, I know we're talking about mothers, but how many couples have got it completely wrong? You still have an opportunity to turn it around.
You can start over.
Yeah. And I'm not talking works-based. I'm talking through the gospel. You have an opportunity. How many mothers got it wrong with a child and have raised them incorrectly and their kids are really badly behaved? You have an opportunity to correct that, to walk the right path. How many mothers in the past have a questionable sexual past, have a questionable relationship past, have an awful past of what has been done to them? You have an opportunity to do it right. And when I say do it right, not get everything perfectly.
Yeah.
It's clear that two sons were raised and they weren't always great to each other. You know, it's clear that Eve was still under the curse and that she had sin, but she had an opportunity and she took it and she raised children. And so, yeah, this to me is a little out of left field in that how many mothers today have got it wrong and feel the weight of that. Yet in Eve, we have an example of someone that got it wrong and kept going.
Yeah, that's great.
So
that's good.
That's why Eve.
Yeah, I was not expecting that.
No.
But it's good.
And when I first read this question, I thought the name that came to my mind was Hannah. Then the second name that came to my mind was Mary. Like, surely we need to mention Mary. Yeah. And then the third name that came to my mind was Eve. But also just imagine the depths of sorrow of we ruined it. We ruined everything.
Mm.
And then still to raise children.
Amazing. Yeah. Look forward to seeing Eve in the new heavens and earth.
Yeah.
And Adam as well. Man, it's been great talking with you. If you enjoy the podcast, listener, if you think it's great hearing from us, give us a good review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. And until next time, may Jesus be big in your church. You've been listening to the For the Church podcast, hosted by Jared Wilson, found online at ftc.co. This resource is brought to you by Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary in Kansas City, Missouri, where we train leaders for the church.